Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And here we are live. So Miriam Halachmi, as the Jews would say, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much, Mel, and thank you for inviting me from chilly London.
Actually, I'm in chilly Athens right now, but and it is chilly. And we're here to celebrate your brand new book, which is so new that it doesn't come out till 2 weeks from now.
Well, it's out in London, but I think
okay.
Yeah, and I think it's just come out. People are getting it in Israel and America. So I think gradually it's appearing. But it's been out in London since October the 1st.
Okay. So how do the Brits pronounce your name?
Okay, so you know that I'm the only Miriam Halachmi on the internet. If you Google my surname, because obviously this name is not originally from London. It was from Baghdad, and the family name was Chabaza. And when they came to Israel, they Hebraicized the name, and it's all to do with lacham lechem, bread baker. So they invented Halachmi, which works in Israel, but we don't have the chet in London or in America. So my brother-in-law, the sculptor Oded Halachmi, many people might know him, when he came to study art in London, he invented the English spelling. So it's the third, you know, transliteration of the name. And because he put the silent H in, we say Halachmi. Nobody else spells it that way. So if you are from the Halachmi family, once the internet appeared, we have unique names on the internet.
Yeah, it's one of the good things, right?
Excellent.
I'm probably the only Melvin Rosenberg with a Y. But nobody looks for me. I forgot to say that my name is Mel Rosenberg, and I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network. And I'm here with Miriam Halachmi. I'm going to call you Miriam Halachmi.
Yes, I like
to celebrate your brand new book, A Boy from Baghdad, published by Green Bean in Britain. And tell us a little bit about the book. I'm interested in your life and career, but a few words about your book.
Well, as I said, thank you so much for inviting me on. This is the book. It's got the most beautiful cover. Here is the River Tigris, the desert river going through Baghdad. And on the back of the book, we have the synagogue. And so we have the minarets, we have the synagogue. And the Iraqi Jews talk about the beautiful life of old Baghdad. When I met my husband in London, in 1977-78, that sort of era, before we got married even, I had no idea who he was. And this is a man who presents himself as, I grew up in Israel, but I'm an Iraqi Jew, or what? And we had no knowledge, we had no context, we knew nothing, and we are Jews. So I'm very much an Ashkenazi Jew. I was born in London in 1952. But it is interesting that the Persian Jews claim me for my own. We are quite dark. This used to be dark. And my brothers and I, and my grandfather, we think, had Persian blood. But we have no Persian culture in us. I've acquired that through Persian friends.
What's your maiden name?
My maiden name is Berkovich. Well, the family,
That's an Ashkenazi name.
an Ashkenazi name, my family come from Zduńska Wola in Poland, and on my mother's side from Lodz. So we are, the original Settled Jews. We know all about the Ashkenazi life and then the Anglo-Ashkenazi life with our own pronunciation of Hebrew in synagogue and bagels and smoked salmon and borscht and all that food and that whole culture, alongside our English culture. And then I meet Raphael Halakhby. And I am plunged into a world I had no idea of. I go to visit the family. They are a huge family. He's the youngest of eight children. Here they are, this beautiful photograph taken on the roof of their house in Jaffa when they left the Marbara. And there's my husband kneeling up the little boy. Just to look at that photograph, and to think about the Ashkenazi world. Would you think that you're even looking at Jews? And this, I think,
Well,
allows.
I don't know how you grew up in London, but we knew that there were Sephardic Jews when I grew up in Ottawa, and the Jewish intelligentsia in Canada were Jews from Morocco who lived in Montreal. So
Well, I would say no, there was no mixing of the Jews from and no learning about it. We didn't learn about it in shul, we didn't learn about it in cheder, we certainly didn't learn about it in school because we never learned about Jews in school. I grew up in a Christian country in an Ashkenazi culture, and suddenly this huge, rich, beautiful culture, which is completely different. Food, customs, language. They spoke Judeo-Arabic, Hebrew, bits of French, bits of English. They yelled all sorts of things at them. Huge family. Every time you go, and those small flats in Israel that people lived in the 70s, I think it's improved and with no air conditioning. There would be 15 people minimum in the room every time I turned up anywhere. And everywhere you have to eat, it's huge. And things that I just, it was, I was plunged into a world I knew nothing of. But of course, it was very exciting, and
Did
I'm a
you
writer.
eventually learn how to cook the kuba
Yeah, we cook kuba. I cook
and
sweet and sour
baba tamar?
chicken and the bebe biscuits. We've got some on the go at the moment. So
Amukhele.
yes, I watched my mother-in-law, and I did make some of the dishes. And I love Arabic music, I have to say, and I can sing along with some of them. And I love the culture. It wasn't difficult. It was just so strange and so different. And so one of the things for me over the years, and I have written poetry about the stories that particularly my brother-in-law Oded told me, because he has very good recall. He was 12 when he left. My husband was a baby. And he has a very good recall of the life. And I made lots of notes and I wrote poetry and short stories. I hadn't thought about writing a book for children, but equally, there wouldn't have been the encouragement to do that 8, 10 years ago, not in this country. There is an issue about, Jewish stories of the Holocaust or Anne Frank. There wasn't a lot of interest in a wider. It has changed. There are more children's writers now, and there is wider. And I was very worried about this book. I thought this is a very niche book. Thank God I met Michael Bean and PJ Alway have taken the book. They'll be distributing 5,000 copies to their family membership. But I thought it won't get any further than that. I have spoken at non-Jewish school librarian conferences, and they're all fascinated. There is a real interest. The book is getting very well reviewed. So I decided about 2 or 3 years ago that I wanted to write a book about the Iraqi Jews because I didn't see it in children's literature anywhere. I've read Eli Amir, the Dove Flyer. I've interviewed him for the Jewish Chronicle in London. It's like interviewing my brother-in-law. It was fantastic. And I've read that book 3 times. And I've read Sami Michael. Those are the only two translated into English where I can read about, adult literature about the Iraqi Jewish experience. But what about children? And what about my grandsons who know their Saba was born in Iraq? But what does that mean to them? So I decided to write a story about it. And I was very encouraged by PJ Alway, who distributes books by Jewish authors on Jewish subjects. They're not all Jewish authors, on Jewish subjects to Jewish children to promote Judaism. They've distributed 6 million books worldwide. And I put this to them and said, you know, are you interested in this? And they said, we have all the parents saying all you publish is Ashkenazi stories and we want the diversity. Here's this word, diversity. Diversity is not something outside the Jewish world. We are a very diverse people. And we need our stories to be told for our children, let alone for everybody else's children. So they encouraged it. I said, look, when the Iraqi Jews went to Israel, my husband's family have told me there was prejudice. It was difficult. What do you feel about me putting this into a children's book? You must tell the story. So I'm a very egalitarian person, and I have been honest about the difficulties and also, you know, shown that there were people who did not buy into that kind of prejudice. So I hope that the arc of the story opens a door for people on a fascinating culture and a fascinating world. And I loved writing it.
That's very good. It's a semi-own voices book. Yes. And I'm wondering what your husband's take would have been had he stayed in Israel, not gone to live in London. Do you think, because we talked a bit about this, it's a slice of life that everybody remembers from the early days of Israel in the 1950s, and especially my own family. Like you say, you know, Jews strive to be better than other people, but we sure have our foibles. And when the Ashkenazi Jews came to live in New York and the Sephardim were there, they were not made to feel comfortable either. So, we traveled the world for 2,000 years, as you said. And because of basically mainly evil things, we started to get to know each other, which was hatred and prejudice and persecution, which drove us together. And then, oh my goodness, there's Jews that speak Ladino and there's Jews that speak, you know, my sister's married to a wonderful Jewish guy whose parents are from Turkey, and I married a Sephardi, into a Sephardi family from Iraq. It's, your story is a very poignant slice of life from the early years of the country. I would argue that we still have issues. But it was hard for me to fit in as a Canadian who came when I was 18. It was hard for the Ethiopian Jews, but 20, 30, 40 years have passed and they are now well-regarded and they're in the Knesset and they're in the army. And certainly, Jewish people are human beings. So tell me a few vignettes from this wonderful book and how you got the idea of the swimming.
Yes. You know, I write contemporary and historical realistic fiction for children, teens and adults. And in fact, this is my 10th published novel. And therefore, I am inspired by very challenging subjects. And my husband's story is fascinating, but there are very challenging sides to it. And I don't want to write an ultimately very serious book that goes on and on and on. I've done more research than you can imagine, because although I was told a lot of anecdotes, as I say, by my brother-in-law, every fact in my book is backed up as far as I can. And I've read and reviewed a lot of books that have been published here, and I've seen documentary material and talked to people, Iraqi Jews and non-Jews. So the facts are very important to me, but I don't want to write a book that's like walking through mud. So I like to have humor in my book. So my main character, Salman, is 12 years old, Salman Shasha. We used that name. I asked my husband's oldest friend, Chaim Shasha, very well-known family, can I use your surname? It's so beautiful. And it's also very easy for Anglo-speaking children to pronounce. And it's a very, you know, engaging name. So he was very pleased to have the name. So Salman Shasha is 12 years old and he has his best friend is his cousin Latif. Because in very big families and very close families like the Iraqi Jewish families, you found your friendships, you know, amongst your cousins, really. And, you know, my husband is the youngest of eight. He has more cousins than I can imagine. I've met them all. But I know that I'm going to be telling four children, and I've got 7 and 8 year olds reading this book as well as adults, that it's, and even for adults, it's going to be a hard story. It's a hard scrabble story. They arrive in Israel in 1951. The country's 3 years old. You know, I said this to this group of librarians I was talking to, and Salman wants to swim. And I said, there were no swimming pools. And they said, what? No swimming pools in Israel. I said, the country's 3 years old. You think the first thing they're going to build is a swimming pool? You know, so if people have a very, they don't have any view of Israel in 1951. So hopefully I've given them some sort of sense. And they've got a very, very difficult life ahead of them. So his best friend is Latif. And I make him the humor in the book, because if there's no humor, every single time things go wrong, you know, who's going to cheer us up? And then the other thing is, I love sports. And I have to give Salman something special about him. I love the whole idea of them learning to swim in the Tigris River. There was a lovely Iraqi Jewish lady, Samantha Ellis's mum, she's a well-known writer, Samantha, who came to my book launch and said, well, I used to swim in the Tigris River. It's really hard, you know, it's a very choppy river. So, you know, I'm sort of trying to get all this in. So I feel that the swimming and Salman having a goal, which is going to be virtually impossible when he has to leave his country, which he doesn't want to leave, will give a real sort of interest and bring children in, because children love swimming, they love water. You know, I want to give them a context, something, because this book, the historical context of this book is virtually unknown. It's virtually unknown in the adult Jewish world, virtually unknown in the adult children, Jewish children's world, and practically unknown outside the Jewish world. So I'm giving people, I'm asking a lot of people, but then I do when I write. And so in relation to my husband and his family, they were quite a political family. And there were several of them who left to live abroad because they felt the prejudice against them was never going to die down. And it made them very angry. But they all have recognized that the country has moved on and that things are different. But they hold it, you know, they are still angry at the way their parents were disrespected. My father-in-law was a goldsmith. I never met him, unfortunately. He was the first person in Iraq to import machines to cut gold. He was known as Abu Hamakain. My Judeo-Arabic is awful. And people came from all over the country to stay overnight in Baghdad so that he could cut their gold and they didn't have to use a saw. He was a well-known man, well-respected. He comes to Israel, they spray him with DDT and he can't get a job. He has to work on the roads. So, you know, I think this was very difficult for them. He was a man in his 30s. He wasn't, you know, a young man. He had 8 children. Mm-hmm. He had, you know, young men in his family, 12, 15 years old. But his mother was a Zionist. She was very much behind, let's come to Israel. Salman represents my father-in-law and the Jews who did not want to leave Baghdad. He resists it. He won't even learn Hebrew. He goes to underground mm-hmm. classes.
Why was that?
I think that they all interpreted what was going on in their own way. And my father-in-law was, you know, perhaps successful and wanted to stay in Baghdad and cope with the, a bit like the Jews that stayed on after Hitler came to power. There were 6,000 or 7,000 Jews who stayed on, and we know how their lives became impossible until they were running away, and the Kurds were spiriting them over the mountains. Their world was very, very different. Edwin Shuker talks about this, and I know he's quite well known. But they were, you know, they left in that sort of first huge tranche when the community, Eli Amir says that it's the first time in history and practically an entire community has got up and left a country. You know that the Iraqi government thought when they set this thing, well, you can go, we'll allow an airlift, but you've only got a 1 year window. After that, forget it. And they thought 8,000 Jews would go. They had no idea that 120,000 Jews, one third of Baghdad, the wealth and the education that would get up and leave. There was no music on the Arab radio in Iraq for 20 years because the Jews played all the musical instruments.
The Jews were so important. Iraq fell apart after the Jews left.
Eli Amir
politically, economically, musically, in every walk of life. So it's very interesting because I wish that my late father-in-law were here, because he would have said, yes, this did happen, but we've moved on, and most of the Iraqi Jews who stayed and persevered, along with everybody else, including American Jews and the Jews from Iran and everywhere, they would today, I think, especially the situation, be very proud of what we've achieved, while saying, yes, we have a lot more to aspire towards. Miriam, let's talk about your career, your life growing up in London, how you became an author, your career in education.
I was a very good girl. You know, a quiet little girl. Well, no one spoke in England in the 1950s. You know, nobody wanted to know what children had to say. I don't know what it was like in Israel, but, you know, we were expected to go to school, behave ourselves, and we never spoke.
Well, I grew up in Canada, and you were not allowed to be left-handed, and we had to pray to Jesus, so...
Yeah, no, we didn't. I didn't quite have that. My mother had that growing up. I mean, I went to school. I was a good girl. I did all my exams. But my mother says I taught myself to read. She said, I realized by the time you were 3 and a half, you weren't just telling the story. You were actually reading the words. So reading was I always say to the children, I go into school, the most important thing I did as a child was reading, except for playing out, because I was also a very adventurous kid. Reading was important to me, and I always wrote. I wrote from when I could pick up a pen. And then when I was 10, I read Anne Frank's diary. And the most important thing for me at that time, I mean, obviously this is a very sad story, but she was a very good writer. She would have been gone on to write amazing things. And she said, this is how I'm practicing. And I thought, oh, I can do that. So I've been writing journals ever since, not continuously, but I do a lot of diary writing. And it is good practice, and a lot of note writing for sort of all my books. I've always got, I haven't got them around me at the moment, I've always got notebooks with the next, you know, the next project in. But I didn't tell anybody, because there was no creative writing classes. In school, you wrote essays. You didn't write stories. Nobody, the word creative didn't exist when I was growing up. And then I went to university, and I trained to be a teacher, and I studied history, which is my great love. And after university, and I was writing all through these years, didn't tell anybody. I did teach myself the guitar. I was quite musical. I played piano, clarinet, taught myself the guitar, and wrote songs, because it was the folk era. So my poetry, I was writing poetry a lot, and that went into, but, you know, I wouldn't ever submit anything. Well, there was nowhere to submit for publication. I don't know what people did. You know, it wasn't a world I could enter. I just hoped that one day it might happen. After university, I travelled abroad. I lived abroad for 2 years. I travelled quite a lot, and I wanted to live and work and learn the language. And I spent a year in France, and then I came to Israel. I came to see what it is, whether I want to be here, do I want to live here? And I did an Ulpan. I made sure I learned the language. I did all the right things. And I lived on the Golan Heights in Moshav Nineveh Ativ the first year that the ski season opened. It was completely mad. And the raid on Entebbe happened while I was there. So we wake up that morning, and the manager of the hotel, the ski lodge, who, you know, hardly looked like your sort of standard Israeli hero, has a gun over his shoulder. And we're going, well, why have you got your gun? You know, and he said, well, everybody's got to be armed now, because haven't you heard? And then, you know, the story came out. So that was it. There's always something happens in Israel. Every year something happens. So if you're there for a year, something will happen, and that's what happened. And the country when I arrived was quite depressed. Everyone's walking around after the 73 war. I saw a lot of injury and depression. And then the raid on Entebbe happens, and the whole country, you know, jumps up, and it was, of course, an amazing achievement. So I came home from Israel because the relationship didn't work out. You know, I think you have to find a niche. You either meet someone you stay with, or you find a career or something. But that didn't work out for me. I had a wonderful year, and it stood me in very good stead. And then I met my husband 2 years later in London. So I was teaching and always writing. And then after I had my children, I've got a boy and a girl, and I've got two gorgeous little grandsons. Jacob and Samuel. Don't get me started. That will be the rest of the podcast. After I had my children, a creative writing class started in the Golders Green Library at the top of my road. And I thought, well, now I'll have a chance to see if there's anything there. And I started to get published within a year. So it was there.
That's very rare. That's very rare.
It was a short story. It was short stories and poetry and book reviews. And I started a novel.
Does it matter? Yeah. You know, Miriam, I've interviewed over 100 authors, and to have a book or short story, whatever, published traditionally, is a real feat. And as far as books are concerned, you are one in a thousand. For every traditional book, and you've had 10, so that's quite incredible.
Oh,
so
thank you,
pat Mel. Yourself on the back for me.
Yes, it's one of those careers, you know, you never quite know where you are. But
so within a year, you were publishing already.
Yeah.
But you also had two kids and a day job.
Yeah. And this is it. I had to go back into teaching and did an MA. So you can't really write novels. You can write poetry. And I have published 3 poetry collections. And you can do, you know, book reviews and bits of articles and things. The short story was never really my thing. I have done more short stories, and they are in anthologies for children. But I sort of fell into children's writing. I was asked to do something, and I had a go, and it was like a tap turned on. I thought, I love this. So as I came out of teaching, that's what I developed, and I started to write the novels. And I think it would interest people to know that about the writing of this novel. So I had the idea, and it was accepted, and then COVID comes along, and it's 2020. And I'm trying to write a novel because we're all sitting at home. I hated COVID. Don't tell me, oh, I did lots of work or I did all this X. I hated every minute of it. And being separated from my grandchildren was like, I broke my heart. So I start to write this novel and it's like walking through mud. I get to the end of 2020 and forget it. I've got about 10,000 words. And I think, you know, I'm not going to be writing a novel in COVID. And January, February 2021 was appalling here. We had snow. You couldn't even go out for the 1 hour you were allowed out. We were all in lockdown. I think that lockdown, we went mad. I think the world went mad. But for some reason, the engine turns on. And I go to my typewriter. I'm typing away. I finish a chapter. I go to Rafi. I read the chapter. He goes, I love it. I just need to ring so-and-so to check about that piece of information or that Arabic word or the Marbara. We're ringing all around the world. It's this communal project. And I'm writing a chapter a day. And I finished the book by the end of February 2021. And I think it kept us sane, to be honest.
For sure. And your relationship with Michael and the Green Bean?
Well, this was wonderful, really. I no longer am with my agent. It was very amicable coming apart because I was going in different directions. But when I told her about my book, she said, Miriam, I can't publish that. I can't get that published. She already felt that the UK children's market would just not be very interested because although people go on and on about diversity, we Jewish children's writers, who I can practically name on one hand, don't feel that that is really being recognized. And this is something that I've started to talk to people about and the school librarians and saying to them, look, it is absolutely right and proper that we study Black history and not just once, again and again, the slave history and what before and what after, and that we study the Irish famine in this country. We should certainly know all about that. But the Jewish narrative does not just belong to the Jews. It is part of everyone's history, and it is not solely focused on the Holocaust and the shtetl. There are many, many different Jewish stories, all of which are equally valid, all of which are equally important. And people are nodding as I'm saying this. They're not sort of going, what's she talking about? They are, you know, it's like pennies dropping. That do I know the Jewish narrative? Well, most people don't. They think and if they've learned about the Holocaust, they've forgotten about it all, or they're now denying it or whatever. They don't know this. They don't know the Yemenite narrative. They don't know the Libyan narrative. I don't know that I know the Libyan narrative. And unless we have these stories told, and I don't know whether this is true or not, but we think this is the first time this story has been told for children in any language. Now, it may be there is a story in Israel, but I'm not aware, and I have friends who sort of looked out. Certainly, I would say not in English as a novel. So it's an opportunity to get that story out there. And we started from a different place, and I was going to say something else. What was it we started this bit with?
With Jewish voices.
Yes.
Green Bean, Michael.
Oh, Green Bean, how I came to... So I didn't know who was going to publish it in England. And then Katriella Friedman and Madeline Travers at PJ Alway said, you should talk to Michael Leventhal. We'll introduce you. And Michael is publishing, he's in his fifth year now of Green Bean Books, publishing books on Jewish themes. He's published Ivor Badil, David Badil's brother, wonderful book, Ben's Bonkers Bar Mitzvah. And he read my manuscript. And this was in 2022, my heart's in my mouth. I'd had major surgery, actually, and I got an email from him the week after. And I handed my phone to my husband and said, oh, I can't bear it. And he says, no, there's nobody else, you know, who understands this story. He loved it. He loved it. The relationship with Michael right from the beginning has been absolutely on side, absolutely. He's the one, we have a recipe for bebe biscuits, date biscuits, in the back of the book. He's a great foodie. He publishes Jewish cookbooks. And he said, let's have a recipe in the back. And I thought, great, you know. And
so these are the famous baba tamar.
Yeah, these are the date ones. And there's lots of different kinds. My mother-in-law
do you make them?
Yeah, we make date biscuits.
Okay, so you have to be prepared for me coming over next visit to the UK.
You have to come and see us, Mel, and we'll fill you full of...
I shall indeed. I'm rather afraid to come now with everything that's going on in London. So
that's interesting.
your writing is lovely. Are you worried that people are going to misinterpret your book or use it saying, oh, you see, Jews are evil, Jews are bad, Israel is bad? Israel is
racist.
This
is possible. Okay,
we talked about this. You know, we're a country and we have prejudices. people expect us to be 100 times better than everybody else when we're maybe twice as good, and we aspire to be. What's your take on this?
So I always say, Hitler said that the Jews are different to everybody else, so we'll exterminate them. But he's wrong. We are the same as everybody else. We have the same spectrum of people. And, you know, trying to hide away and pretend we don't because we're afraid somebody's going to use it. Well, let's face it, they use whatever they can anyway. You know, the anti-Semitism in London since October the 7th is unspeakable. But actually, Hanukkah was a great turning around. And Hanukkah was celebrated here. Every menorah that could be lit on the streets and in the windows, non-Jewish people put menorahs up and lit them. I felt it. There was a tiny little bit of graffiti, but it was almost, I can't even quote you when and where. And so there was, so you know, the British people have a very strong sense of fairness. And we have marched about anti-Semitism here, and we have made it absolutely clear. So what I say now about Israel is Israel is an imperfect country. Now show me one that's perfect. So, you know, I this whole kind of business of Israel has to be more than something and this and that and the other, it isn't. It is what it is. There are every different kind of Jew in the world, in the diaspora, which is a perfectly valid place to be, where half of us live, and the other half live in our national homeland and also have all sorts of different wonderful, wonderful sides. And unfortunately, sides, it's a bit like my rabbi used to run a course called The Bits of the Bible We're Ashamed Of. You know, I'm not proud of every word in the Torah, and that's the way it is. We are an imperfect people. Now, the whole thing about, yes, I thought this was a very niche book anyway, because nobody knows this story, and I thought a lot, I might just get indifference, quite honestly. And yes, people could take this book and use it as another stick to bash us, like everything else that's going on since October the 7th and before. But Actually, this is where I've been so amazed. I have done lots of different talks to lots of different groups, most of whom are not Jewish, because most people in Britain aren't. And all they're saying to me is, and I talk about, it was difficult. The Ashkenazi Jews did have this superiority complex. They did look down on the Middle Eastern Jews. It has changed, but it was very painful for my husband and his family at the time. And, not everybody was like that. And I balance it up with the Ashkenazi Jews who were open-minded. So Salman meets both kinds. But they haven't then turned around and said, oh, well, what do you expect from Israel? It's a genocide, apartheid, all this stuff and nonsense we get. I haven't had any of that. I have had one Jewish person say to me, I have to say to you, Miriam, that this worries me and everybody will think all Ashkenazi Jews are racist against. And I answered her and said, well, I'm sorry, but I haven't had that response. And I have talked about my book as widely as I can. And, here I am now. I don't know who my audience is. It could be anybody from anywhere, which is fantastic. And I hope that I speak to everyone. I will say also, just along those lines, that I have a reputation for being a peace activist. I've done interfaith work for decades, and I'm very big on social media, and you follow me, you will see that mostly what I say is I wish for peace for all life on earth, because I'm just as I think the plants and the animals are just as important as the humans.
Wonderful. Well, I'll just say it's usually not the case that I interview people who have such a similar history. I have two kids, two grandchildren. I married an Iraqi, and I love Bibik Damar. And I think that the only point of difference here is that I chose to stay in Israel. I came when I was 18, to another kibbutz, and I stayed. And I'm very proud of what we've accomplished, and I'm, of course, cognizant, is that the right word, of our imperfections. But I would have to say that as a Jewish person, I do think that we have to be better. If we aren't, then we have to get on it. This is has always been what I think. So when Jews get things wrong, when they we have to take a very close look at ourselves. I think that this is why I stayed in Israel. And so your book is really it's something that should be told, and it's something that happened to many. I would say practically all of the Jews from Iraq who came in 1951. It's a sad episode, it's something that we have to learn from going forward.
And I have to say that the Israeli family and the Iraqi family around the world are very, very excited about this book. And their excitement is because their story is being told. Now, I know that Eli Amir and Sami Michael, and I think there are Israeli writers, because I can't read in Hebrew, who have written. But here again, and I come from where they come from. I'm part of their family and the friendship group that we have. And so it's being told anew, with a fresh insight, I hope, because I don't come from the Iraqi community, but I've been married into it for 45 years. And I know my bits of Hebrew. So then, Chai, Shwaya, Shwaya, Habibi. I can do it. I wish I spoke Arabic, Judeo-Arabic. But it's a constant learning curve. It's really, really beautiful. My husband and I do talk about this philosophy of the Jews should be better. And I think that he feels it very much because they experience the prejudice. And, why are Jews dishing out what they have complained about happening to them? So this is an important issue that, I think Israel has tackled it and has thought about it. And I think that is the thing to admire, the constant desire to strive to be better.
Miriam, we had this talk. My children prefer to be called Iraqi Jews than Ashkenazi Jews. I think that says it all.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's lovely. My children are very proud of the Iraqi Jewish origin.
And they should be.
Of course they should.
2,500 years of tradition.
I know, anybody was there.
So, before we go, I always ask my published authors for a few tips for the aspiring authors in the trenches.
Well, if you want to write, first of all, you have to read as widely as possible. It's no good saying to yourself, well, I just want to write fantasy, and you just read that. You're just going to narrow your options down. You need to know, you need to see good writers succeeding and work out how they did it, which is actually how I learned to write, because we didn't have creative writing classes. I would recommend going to creative writing classes and check out the credentials of the tutor and make sure they're published and they know how to do it, because a lot of people put themselves out there. And you have to work. You have to persevere. There is no easy route to writing anything. I didn't start with a novel. I started with doing lots of short, different things, learning how to write through my creative writing classes. And then I spent years beforehand writing bits and pieces anyway. Just because you can write a lot, because you've been taught to be literate, doesn't mean you can write a novel. You have to work out how to do that. The novel is the marathon. And don't give up. Lots of people do. And then there are those of us who keep going. And in my case, you can actually read one of my books, which is really nice.
And I highly recommend that people do. Miriam, this was wonderful. I learned so much. I've been here with Miriam Halakhmi, celebrating, show the book, wave it around. A Boy from Baghdad, published in 2 weeks, officially by Green Bean. From somewhere in Athens to somewhere in London, this is Mel Rosenberg for the New Books Network. I'm the host of the Children's Literature Channel. Usually I talk about picture books, which is my soft spot, but it was wonderful talking with Miriam on a middle grade, so close to my heart, A Boy from Baghdad. And Miriam, I cannot wait to taste your date. What do you call them in England?
Date biscuits. We look forward to having you in London, Mel.
And as the Jews say, Yishar Koach, and the best wishes to your husband. I can't wait to meet him and talk to him about his experiences. Good luck with this book and all your other books. And best regards to Michael and all my friends in London. So until we meet, it's been wonderful. Shalom. Peace. And keep up the
Thank
good
you very
work.
Much. Thank you very much, Mel. It's been wonderful. Shalom, peace, salam.
For me also.